little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics, and my name is Bob Frelick. I'm here remotely with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hello, Bob. Good to be here, wherever that is.
Let's start out like we usually do. Not that we're in a rut or anything, but it's important to right at the start here get out our contact information so folks can get back to us, give us feedback about the show, and pop up our previously archived podcast versions of Thinking Clearly.
If you are a podcast listener like myself, you can find us on your favorite podcasting app. Just open it up and search for Thinking Clearly and subscribe to that podcast. You can find our entire archive there or by visiting thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. That's LIBSYN.com. And lastly, we are, like many other people, on Facebook. So just pull up your Facebook, search Thinking Clearly Radio, and we should come right up. And you can find promos for upcoming shows as well as the posted finished podcast.
Well, I want to say, Julia, that for this episode, it's you and I, and we're going to tackle a variety of topics. We have no guest on this episode. Well, let's start out, Julia, and we do this every once in a while. I think it's important because sometimes people will just find our podcast or just tune us in on in our live broadcast, and they will be novices to what critical thinking is. So let's just take a few minutes to review our definition, our working definition, and it is a work in progress. It's changed just recently, too, and we take suggestions about this. But it has two parts. There's a working definition, which is a legitimate definition, and then we have some additional attitudes or mindsets that go along with being a good critical thinker. So I'm going to read our working definition of critical thinking. It goes like this. Critical thinking is a mode of thinking that uses the process of logical reasoning based on a thorough examination and evaluation of a robust cross-section of evidence relevant to the issue at hand when forming claims, conclusions, opinions, and beliefs. Why don't you give the longer description of critical thinking?
Oh, goodness. All right. Well, this has been growing and expanding and clarifying. So our longer description is, critical thinking also includes an awareness of, an attempt to compensate for, the vulnerabilities we all have in our thought processes, including cognitive biases such as confirmation bias, one of my favorites. Critical thinking is most effective when there's a basic understanding of the scientific method, a certain minimum amount of basic literacy in the content area relating to the issue we are examining, and the willingness to be a lifelong learner. Critical thinking is best complemented by having a mindset of genuine curiosity when examining and communicating our ideas, a willingness to acknowledge and evaluate evidence that may be contrary to our own conclusions, and an openness to considering alternative conclusions and beliefs. Did I get that right, Bob?
I think you got it right. And I think pleased our last guest on Thinking Clearly, Andy Norman, who made it a big point in saying that the traditional critical thinking, which was just the part in the working definition, which is evidence-based reasoning based on logic connecting to premises that we can call evidence. That's the working definition. But he underscored the importance that we have to go beyond that. And I think we knew that from the start, because when we started this show, we got into the whole psychological literature about cognitive biases, confirmation biases, and heuristics. And we're going to talk a little bit about that today. And then we added as we went because we found out it's important to, and especially when we're talking to journalists, it's important to have some background information about any of the issues that we're actually investigating and exploring with critical thinking. And it's a good procedure and idea to have some idea of the reasoning involved with the scientific method. So we added all those other things. And the last thing to be added here just recently was curiosity. That was mentioned way back when I listened to a lot of Kevin De La Plante's critical thinking courses. And we're going to talk about Kevin a little bit today. He mentioned that, but it came back to me kind of in full force when I read a recent book by Julia Galef. It's called The Scout Mindset. And Julia Galef does a podcast called Rational Thinking. Have you listened to that at all?
I have. It's a great podcast.
It's wonderful. And the book that she took great pains to write, making sure that it was rationally correct, is out, and it's called The Scout Mindset. And the theme in the book is that it explains the importance and the advantages of adopting the mindset of a scout. A scout is that person who goes out. They're primarily interested in being accurate. You know, they want to find out what's really out there. If the bridge is out and the army is advancing, they want to know. They don't want to have an ideology that gets in the way and says, we're winning the war, let's charge ahead. They want accurate information. That's the scout mindset. And that's as opposed to the soldier mindset, which most of us are in most of the time or a lot of the time. And the soldier mindset is someone who is there to win the argument, to advocate for their pre-existing belief, or to do virtue signaling. So the book is good in that respect, in that it engages our genuine curiosity. We really want to know. A scout really wants to know.
Yeah, and I think it's a good way on expanding on being open-minded, something that we've talked about a lot. It's critical thinking requires open-mindedness, but that's sort of a way of being, which is important, but there's something about curiosity that's a little bit more proactive than just simply being open-minded. So I think that's a great expansion and clarification on a mindset that really is conducive to critical thinking.
What I'd like to talk about in this episode is that, first of all, how important this show has been to me in terms of staying engaged intellectually with this topic. And so I've learned an incredible amount in the last 5 years. And it's coming up on 5 years. Our first show was July 7th of 2016. So we're getting close to the 5-year mark. But there's still a list of things that I'm still trying to understand at a deeper and deeper level. So that's what I'd like to discuss on this episode, is some of those things that I've been grappling with. And I know you've been grappling with some of them too, as to on a deeper and deeper level. You can learn something on kind of a superficial level, a medium level. And when you think about them a lot, you find out that there is even a deeper level. And I'd kind of like to go that route for this episode. Oh, by the way, have you seen the movie called Social Dilemma? Or do you know about that?
I do know about it.
Have you got a chance to see it yet?
I have.
You probably saw it before I saw it, because we get Netflix CD where they mail you the CDs, but we don't get streaming stuff here in our rural area where I am. It's on streaming Netflix, and I didn't get a chance to see it.
What century are you in, Bob?
Well, listen, I did though, go to some of my friends that live downstream. And when I say downstream in this area, I mean literally downstream, folks. And they do have streaming Netflix, and I got to watch it there with them, and they saw it once, and they were glad to see it again. But it's great because it really motivates folks. I know it motivated me. It motivated everybody that saw it when in the room that I was at to learn more and practice critical thinking and become what I call an information activist to help us all clean up this polluted information environment that we're in. I suggest watching the movie. A little bit about it is, it was directed by Jeff Orlowski, and it features some really smart people who have like firsthand insight into how social media platforms have been constructed and to be addictive and to manipulate our emotions and behavior, and their role in conspiracy, spreading conspiracy theories and different disinformation. So those interviews that it has, many of them are with former employees and executives from top companies of some of the social media platforms like Facebook, Google, Twitter, Mozilla, YouTube. And these are folks who have become very concerned with how these and other platforms have caused some negative, problematic social, political, cultural consequences. I have a favorite line from that movie. It goes like this: if you're not paying for the product, then you are the product. Did that line stand out to you?
Not necessarily. It's, I think, something I've heard myself say for many years now. I like The Social Dilemma because it very eloquently explains something, frankly, I've been watching for many, many years. And that, you know, we say that you had mentioned that the polluted information environment that we're in, again, we are not passive recipients. We are participating in this environment. And it behooves all of us to be knowledgeable participants who, you know, contribute towards something better and not worse. But that's a value statement we'll get into later.
Yeah. Well, let's go to the first question or issue that I've been thinking a lot about and am unresolved about, and that's the balance between activism and epistemic accuracy. Now, that's a kind of highfalutin term, right?
Epistemic. Bob, what the heck do you mean by that? Come on now.
Epistemic accuracy. Well, epistemic has to do with how we acquire knowledge, how we know what we think we know. And
because it comes from epistemology, right?
Right. And accuracy means that rather than coming up with beliefs that are questionable, improbable, or just downright false, you know, we dig in and use our genuine curiosity to drive our motivation to really get closer and closer to the truth in the issues that we're dealing with, even if there are issues that are talked about by the others, not the group that we're in, but the other group. So we're really focused on trying to get the truth. But the thing that I've thought about is that, in a way, you don't want to be an activist out there ready to, in this area, they climb trees and do tree sits to keep from cutting some of the old growth, or you might be protesting nuclear power or whatever. You don't want to be thinking and have a lot of humility in your belief for that thing that you're going out and trying to be active about or protest. And so, and it, again, it's kind of like back to Julia Galef's book, it's the soldier mindset versus the scout mindset. So I don't know. Have you thought about that issue? Has it come up in your life or any of your thinking?
I think you're tapping into an existential problem I've probably had most of my life that has certainly become amplified more recently in some of the work that I'm doing. So, yeah, this is something I've thought about quite a bit. I think while personally, I'm not a big fan of the militaristic analogies. They serve a purpose. And I would say that, you know, scouts and soldiers rely on each other. And that while it's very difficult to be both at the same time, they often work hand in hand.
But have you ever found yourself kind of flipping back and forth between the activist and the person who's then thinking, trying to think more deeply about the issue and go beneath the surface of the issue? I know I
basically every day I live
every
that.
Day. And it goes back to this idea of having some humility in our ideas. So the question that came up for me that I'm grappling with is, when is it important to turn off our humility and work and fight aggressively for our beliefs? one of the examples I think about is the climate change, global warming, people-made, anthropogenic climate change, and the idea of the dangers of nuclear power. So I think we're all aware of the dangers of nuclear power, but what if you are very pro doing something about climate change, and you are also very strongly against nuclear power, and you go out and protest against any kind of nuclear power? I mean, they're trying to make smaller, safer nuclear power reactors now. And the idea that you actually might be shooting yourself in the foot, because when you really look into the issue, it may be that as a short-term solution, we really need nuclear power to transition off of fossil fuels and find other power sources that are not putting CO2 into the atmosphere. And so you might be actually shooting yourself in the foot by having that activist part of you go out and protest against nuclear power. So sometimes, by taking these dogmatic, inflexible, kind of zero-tolerance positions, we can be our own worst enemies. So that's the issue that comes up for me. And oftentimes when I get upset about something that I hear and I think something should be done about it, when I actually go and look at the issue at a deeper level, I find that it's not quite as clear-cut, not quite as black and white, not quite as motivating enough for me to go out and actually, do something active for that cause or to defend against something that's being done, whatever. So that's the issue that I'm talking about. On the other hand, to be completely thoughtful, overanalytic, you may never get to the point where you're going to go out and do something. And I've had that experience too, So how do that balance? How do we actually make that work? That's the idea that I'm talking about.
Yeah, this is kind of funny, but I'm gonna throw a third factor in there. When I was, as an activist, really grappling with a lot of these ideas and, very much felt a drive to change the world, if you will. Something that was very important for me was to sit back and ask myself, what's effective? I got so worked up, I choked on my own word. As an activist, we're wanting to get something done in a particular area. You gave the example of climate change. But how does that happen? Do we go to university and get a PhD in meteorology or public health? Do we become some kind of expert so that we can speak expertly to the issue? Do we organize with like-minded people and try and get a critical mass that creates a tipping point towards change? I think a lot of the time, we think about these things in a vacuum, and while that's important, we need to sort out our own mind. Once we sort out our own mind of what the issue is and what direction we want to go, I think it's very important that we ask ourselves, how are we going to get there? So I think that's part of the scouting mentality. I think for myself, I consider things in phases. And first, it's the scouting. It's the curiosity, the open-mindedness. What is the deal with this issue? What have people explored before on this issue? Who is doing the work now? What is the truth behind it? That you can get your hands on. And then once we use the critical thinking to kind of create clarity around the issue. So we know sort of our destination. We need to figure out our path to get there. Do we lock ourselves to a gate, or do we write letters to congresspeople? Not that they're mutually exclusive, but they are very different tactics. And I think at a certain point in my life, I realized that the changes I would like to see, I could not do alone. There are things that I could attempt to take on, but really important changes in the world require a certain amount of social mass, people on board. And I think that's where, you know, I had to seriously consider tactics and what tactics are morally acceptable for myself. What would actually be effective in achieving the goal I would like to see.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that I've seen happen, I can't think of times when I've done it, but I've seen it happen to other people that they believe something so strongly, they were activists about it. And then something changed. And oftentimes it's getting more knowledge or being influenced by some other people, and they completely decide completely that they were wrong about the issue. And those for me underscore, I guess, how important it is to get as much information from the start, you know, rather than just go along with the crowd, see something on Facebook and have it push your button and get ready to get angry about it, you know, but to actually, with everything, take the time to actually research it more and to see if there's enough there, if it's assaultive enough on the way you think the world should be and your value system, even after you've gotten the information and done the research on it, then you become the activist. But it's something that I know I'm trying to understand, you know, better and better.
Well, and to that extent, there's a great importance in revisiting those ideas. Perhaps you put a lot of thought and effort and exercise into examining an issue, and then at some time later in your life, you're given a reason to re-examine it. Something that comes to mind for me was I've been a vegetarian most of my life. And when I moved to Humboldt County, I actually started branching out and eating meat because I found that there was non-industrialized meat available. And really the core of my concern was around the industrialization of animal products. And so, you know, changing environments, changing the products I have access to changed my mind and my behavior and also gave me greater clarity as to what my values actually are.
Yeah, that's a great example. Well, let's go on. Another thing that I'm pondering, and this has been nagging me for quite some time, and that's how does culture come into the picture when we're talking about the dual process model. We've talked a lot about system one and system two thinking, which is also known as the dual process model. And how does culture come into the picture when we're actually trying to visualize that model? And we've talked on previous episodes about this, but I want to review it, do a quick review. I'm going to play a clip by Kevin De La Plante, who I mentioned before. He's really one of my all-time critical thinking mentors. He's been a TCE, Thinking Clearly guest on episodes 15 and 24 with us. He has a PhD in philosophy. He taught philosophy and critical thinking for about 20 years at the University of Iowa, and then went into the private sector to continue teaching critical thinking skills, and he established the Critical Thinker Academy and the Argument Ninja Academy. And he's so articulate, I really love his explanation. So I'm going to play a clip from the Critical Thinker Academy, Kevin De La Plante, talking about System 1, System 2, the dual process model.
In these next two episodes, I want to talk about what I believe are the two most important myths or misconceptions about critical thinking. Myth number one. Critical thinking is primarily about improving our conscious, deliberative reasoning processes, like through instruction in logic and argumentation, or other formal tools like learning cost-benefit analysis, for example. Why is this a myth? It's a myth or misconception because what we understand today is that the cognitive processes that issue in beliefs and judgments and decisions involve a complex interplay of conscious and unconscious processes. The term that psychologists use today is dual processing. There are at least two distinct types of cognitive processing that underlie human reasoning. One is fast, automatic, involves feelings and emotional responses in a fundamental way, and is largely outside of conscious control. The other type is slow. It requires conscious attention and effort, and it's what we normally think of as conscious rational deliberation. In the psychology literature, these two types of information processing are sometimes called System 1 and System 2 processing, or fast thinking versus slow thinking, or thinking in terms of automatic presets versus thinking in terms of manual override settings. And the reality is that System 1, the fast, unconscious mode that is dominated by cognitive shortcuts or heuristics, is the dominant mode in most of our everyday decision-making. It interacts with System 2. System 2 can override System 1, but System 2 is generally lazy, and its default mode of operation is just to rubber stamp what System 1 tells it. System 2 thinking is crucially important for deliberative decision-making, of course. But the reality is that we spend only a fraction of our days in System 2 mode compared to System 1. So, if our goal is to improve the quality of our beliefs, decisions, and judgments, we have to understand that all of these are products of this complex dual processing system. And we have to understand that the specific skills associated with conscious deliberative reasoning, like logic and argumentation and other forms of rational deliberation, are only playing a supporting role within this bigger picture of human rationality. The myth, the mistake, is to believe that people can dramatically improve the quality of their reasoning by working out their System 2 muscles. It's a mistake because it ignores the interplay between System 2 and System 1, and the fact that System 1 is most often in the driver's seat when it comes to forming beliefs and making decisions. Now, naturally, this invites the question of what the alternative is. How do you improve the quality of our thinking if most of it is governed by unconscious processes? Well, first of all, congratulations, because now you're asking exactly the right question. This is where critical thinking education has to go if it wants to be genuinely relevant and useful. And the answer, not surprisingly, is that it's complicated. But every year, the folks who research these questions are making progress. We can learn to cultivate habits of thought that are known to improve the quality of our judgments. We can educate ourselves about the psychology of cognitive biases and how they structure our thinking, and how they're often used to manipulate us. We can learn how to use simple protocols to minimize bad outcomes due to cognitive biases. We can train our intuitions through practice and repetition to see relevant patterns that inform higher quality judgments. So the upshot is this. Logic and argumentation are always going to have an important role in critical thinking education, but they will need to be supplemented with different kinds of literacy, different kinds of training, if they're going to be effective supporting players in our everyday reasoning.
Any reactions to that, Julia?
Not really.
It's a pretty good summary. And we've talked about these before, but I'll tell you why I bring this back is because I've been trying to figure out, you know, we have inborn genetically developed abilities, cognitive abilities. I call them potentials, you know. Memory is one. Pattern recognition is another. We're able to recognize patterns, very skillful at that, which artificial intelligence is not very good at that. We're very, very good at that. Ability to learn language. Basic inferential reasoning seems to be, when I say wired in, I'm talking about not just through genetics, but through our development. Early on, these things are wired into our brain, cause and effect reasoning included. But what I'm trying to do is to think about how the System 1 and System 2 actually fits into the reality, because that's a model and it's kind of abstract, but how does it actually fit into the model of what's going on in our mind comes from the functions and things that are events that are happening in our brain, and that's neural networks. It's very complicated connections between our neurons and our central nervous system. And so that gives us the ability to have some of these potentials inborn. So I was wondering whether we could kind of look at that as our firmware. You know, firmware in a computer can be updated, but it's something that stays there. It's not like software in that it, we can't add to it. We could change it, but the company has to change it, right? We can't do anything to change it. So it's something that's used repeatedly to do the operations that the computer could do. So I'm trying to find an analog that can help me understand how culture affects and interacts with our system one and system two. So I was remembering Gary Klein, who actually worked with Daniel Kahneman, who on a paper, really interesting paper. And Daniel Kahneman's kind of the grandfather of these system one, system two, and what we call heuristics and biases. And so I'm thinking that I'm beginning to think of system one as being these inborn abilities that I just mentioned, memory, pattern recognition, etc., that are constantly updated as we develop, especially as children. We use our memory, we use our pattern recognition, and it's sort of like updating our firmware. Remember, Gary talked about how firefighters and fighter pilots become experts. And the way they do that is they constantly update whether they were successful in this maneuver that they were doing or not. And the people who are very observant and very receptive to updating and changing their the way they do things become the experts. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting way to look at it. I have to admit the firmware analogy is not really doing it for me. I see where you're going, but for me, I think I would, in trying to sort of find an analogy to explain it, I think of it as our brain and its extension, the nervous system, is like a muscle, and we train it. You know, so if I wanted to become an Olympic level figure skater, I'm not going to be thinking about every single move I make when I make it. But when I'm training, when I'm learning to do, a trick for the first time, I'm going to be thinking about it very, very closely. Do I put my toe here? Do I twist then? Do I put my arm there? And as you practice it, it comes into what I guess people would call muscle memory. It's something that your body comes to innately understand, and you don't have to think about it as closely. So to me, you know, I think it's, they're both pretty similar, you know? Mm-hmm. I think of it more as a training.
Yeah.
Whereas to me, a firmware is like you flash it and replace it. You know, this is a steady ongoing process of actively using our system two when we're thinking about it, you know, and it's not going to be all the time or even most of the time, mm-hmm. using that system to in fact, train, very consciously train the system one in a way that is more conducive to, you know, critical thinking to serve our purposes. And then through that training process, we no longer have to as actively use our system to have those same results. Is that similar?
Yeah. Where I'm at with that helps me parse out the whole idea. Now, I didn't know that firmware, you flashed out the whole thing. You just erase the whole thing and replace it with a new piece of firmware. Or I kind of looked at it as the firmware was there and it got updated. Pieces of it got updated. That's why I use the firmware. I'm not wedded to the firmware analogy.
Both can be true.
But where I would differ a little bit with you is that I would think that the idea of training an Olympic athlete or firefighter or whatever, that is all the updating of our system one. In other words, system one is not just there. System one itself, and that is most of System One is unconscious. You know, there was an incredible amount of thinking, cognition that goes on. Most of it, the majority of it, is unconscious. And there's even now, most of the cognitive scientists are adopting the picture that the only, all of that is done in the background, and our decisions generally are completely made before they ever are spotlighted by our consciousness, and our consciousness is just an after-the-fact spotlight on what our brain has already decided. You know, that gets into the free will argument and all that. So I look at it as, I still look at it as System One is that constantly updated, trained cognition using our built-in potentials. Those are built in. Where a contrast System Two is that I think System Two comes mainly from our culture. Our culture that we've learned to make tools, and essentially our technology, our tools, like, you know, chipping out a arrowhead, very much more complicated. But culture has given us the ability to, and has co-evolved with our genetics, according to a really great book that I read about it. It's by Joseph Henrich, and it's called The Secret of Our Success, How Culture is Driving Our Evolution, Domesticating Our Species, and Making Us Smarter. And this has gone, this reading this book has given me a little bit of grasp on how I would apply that to System One and System Two. So I look at System Two as the contributions from our culture, and our culture is, we're able to imitate people in our culture and develop practices and then pass those on from generation to generation. And that's the strength, the potential of culture. And so that's kind of where I go with it, is that system, to oversimplify it, System One is our genetically kind of wired in at an early age, but can be updatable through our experience potentials. And System Two is the contributions that would never be there from the start, of culture that we've learned through our reading, our education, our watching people, our apprenticing at doing things. And what I'm thinking is that those cultural aspects of System Two are more in our conscious awareness than anything in System One. System One is mainly unconscious. We're not thinking about those things. They're all being done under the hood. They're being done unconsciously. System Two expands our consciousness in a way to include things that we actually have to think about. Doing fractions, the base 10, using statistics, you know, using data, all of that stuff that we talk about when we talk about System Two reasoning, as being a check on our System One judgments and decisions. Am I getting through with where I'm going with that?
I see where you're coming from. I think from my perspective, I think it's far too difficult to draw such a clear line when it comes to culture. And that it really permeates everything we do as social animals. You know, so if, you know, as you're saying, System One's kind of what's hardwired in, well, that hardwiring was your genetics were influenced by the culture of your predecessors. It's a two-way street. And I think culture is much more, its influence is much more pervasive than we often give it credit for.
Oh, definitely. And that's what this book is all about, how culture co-evolved with our genetics. And he goes into excruciating detail, but very, very good read. I'd recommend that book. So I'm not separating them as two completely separate things. Of course, they interact. But I'm gaining a little bit of traction in my thinking about this as looking at System One as whether culture helped evolve that system and those capabilities. Sure, I believe that. But that when we're actually as an individual sitting down, tackling a problem or looking at something that somebody said and having a reaction to it, our first choice that we really don't have a lot of control over is made by our system one. And it takes those things that we've learned from our culture that have been passed down, but we had to learn them as an individual to engage in those. And that's how our system two engages with our beliefs, as a sort of check on our system one. And like Kevin De La Plante said, our system two is actually lazy because it's resource heavy. It's, you know, uses a lot more resources than a quick answer that comes automatically, subconsciously, or unconsciously from our brain.
I don't like calling it lazy myself. I think
I don't either.
energy conservation is a very important fact of both biology and physics. So I'm going to go with energy conservation.
Yeah, it bothers me to call it lazy because it takes a lot of work to engage our, you know, look at the data and crunch numbers and read research papers and that kind of stuff. It takes a lot of energy to do that. But what I'm saying is I think it's a good analogy that our first reaction is to deal with things with our quick intuitive processes. Okay. By the way, Daniel Kahneman is one of the co-authors of a new book called Noise. Have you heard about that?
I think I have. Yeah. He's been doing the rounds on podcasts lately.
Yeah, he has, along with two other people. And I did get that book. It's written with Cass Sunstein, who was known for being in President Obama's administration. Sunstein wrote the book called Nudge, and a third author who I don't know very well, know nothing about. But it's a interesting read. It's pretty technical and talks about how, in addition to cognitive biases, noise, which is kind of variation in decisions that different people make, where in the same case that they make variations, one person will make this judgment. For example, judges do that. They'll give a 40-year sentence, whereas another judge gives a 3-year sentence to the same person. So they've been exposed to all the same information. There's a variety of judgments being made, and that's what that book is primarily about. Well, we're getting along in time here, and so let's move on to talk a little bit about debiasing. And I did have a clip for that, but I think we're not going to be able to play that clip because it's almost 5 minutes, and I think we still have quite a bit to talk about. But debiasing training. In other words, we've talked a lot about biasing, and it's what happens in that system one, and sometimes we're not even aware of it, right? Confirmation bias, where we have a belief, and then the things that stick out when we go look for the evidence are the evidence that support that belief. Sometimes,
and we often talk about the harmful effects of biases, but let's remember they're there for a reason. They serve us most of the time. It's being again, it's our energy conservation thinking. But there is a certain point when there are times that we want to dig in a little bit and be aware of the biases that exist.
Yeah, and I think the way it's talked about in the book Thinking Fast and Slow, Daniel Kahneman's book, is that we have to separate out heuristics from biases. In other words, heuristics are the rules of thumb. One of them is called the availability heuristic, right? We want to go cross country and we from one side of the country to the others, and we're concerned about our safety, and we do want to decide whether we're going to go by air or drive. And we just saw this horrific airline accident where everyone was killed. And so we decide to drive. Or we go to the data and we look at what really is safer. And by far, airline travel is a lot safer than car travel or driving on the roads. So the idea there is that we have that heuristic called the availability heuristic, which sometimes makes mistakes, like in the air travel versus car travel, and that's what we call a bias. So basically, that the difference is that biases are when our heuristics lead us astray, and that's the way it's used anyway in kind of the psychological literature, and that's the way Kahneman talked about it. So you'll hear those, both of those terms, it gets confusing. But biases are generally the things that do us in, stereotyping people, you know. We can be so wrong about that and make a judgment on the basis of stereotypes. And certainly some people fit the stereotypes, but a lot of people don't. So if stereotyping becomes that heuristic of stereotyping gives us a misinformation, that misinformation is our bias. But at any rate, the idea is that we don't want to get rid of heuristics, but we want to get rid of the mistakes made by our heuristics, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's called debiasing. And it's a really hot topic in psychological research now and decision research on decision making. And forecasting also. Can we train people to become aware of and not be swayed by biases, to realize when their heuristic, their shortcut, rule of thumb is actually leading to problematic decisions and false beliefs? And can we train them to overcome the push that those natural biases lead us towards? That's debiasing. And it's really kind of in its infancy. And one of our previous guests, John Cook, is actually involved in that. He's one of the authors on a paper called Debiasing Decisions, Improved Decision-Making with a Single Training Intervention. And what they did is they developed a video game that gave examples, took a person through a scenario, and then pointed out where heuristics led the people astray and their biases showed up, and then gave them feedback about that. So it's like a video game training that is meant to help debiasing people.
Are you talking about the Cranky Uncle?
No, John Cook does that too. That's a cartoon. That's a cartoon that he does to it's not meant to train people. It's meant to sort of point out that our cranky uncle sometimes, has belief systems that are horribly entrenched in biases. He's a person of many talents, John Cook. He's a cartoonist, artist, and a psychologist, and now a video game developer. I just wanted to read what they said in the conclusion of that article. It said the results from their experiments that they were doing with this debiasing, this video game training, it says the results suggest that a single training intervention can improve decision making. We suggest you to use it alongside improved incentives, information presentation, and nudges to reduce costly errors associated with basic, with biased judgments and decisions. And the reason that that field is such a hot topic is because they are actually marketing these things to both education, where critical thinking is taught in schools, and to businesses and corporations where their decisions are very costly. And if you have biases that are creeping into their decisions, it can cost a lot of money. So they're using them as training for executives and management folks in business. So it's kind of exciting. I'm keeping an eye on it to see what's new in that field. Any other thoughts about that?
Well, I had a pretty good example of the how the same sort of reasoning can be both useful and a problematic bias.
Go for it.
All right. So sometimes this is called the gambler's fallacy, which is considered the tendency to think that future probabilities are altered by past events. So one example of a way that this could be true is, I would say, you know, every time I go to the casino, I lose my money. Those are past events informing the probability of future events, right? Because there's a commonality here. I'm the one who keeps going to the casino. When I get to the casino, I may have flipped a quarter five times and had heads every time. When I go to flip that quarter a sixth time, what might my bias be?
Well, your bias is going to be it's got to come up tails.
It's got to come up. It's come up heads five times in a row. That's unheard of.
We know 50% of the time it's going to come up heads and 50% of the time it's going to come up tails. And you've flipped it a number of times. It's come up heads. It's got to come up tails that next flip, right? I mean, if the probability is really with it.
Right. Except the probability is for each time you flip that coin.
That's right.
So it is 50%. Each on that sixth flip, it's still 50%.
Yeah, yeah.
I bring those up because those are two kinds of rationalizing. One, which is completely true. I lose my money every time I go to the casino because I'm the common denominator that keeps gambling away my money because
right.
I have poor gambling choices. And the other is the belief that these previous flips affect the sixth flip of a coin. I just like that example because it's literally the same type of logical reasoning applied in different ways that in one way is true and informative, and in another way is a bias that's deceitful and leads you in the wrong direction.
Yeah. And that's a good example because it is so compelling to think that you got five heads in a row and that it's not going to come up tails that sixth time. I mean, everything in our, that's such a great example because everything in our intuition says it's got to come up. But to actually come up, it would have had to change something in the coin, right? It would have had to take that fair coin and make it into an unfair coin or whatever to change the probability because the probability is the same. That's the law of large numbers. Those odds only pertain to many, 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 many flips of the coin where you can expect 50% one and 50% the other. Great example. Well, we're getting close to
100% chance I'm going to lose my money at the casino, though.
Yes, that's again the law of large numbers because the casino has everything set up so that you are paying for everything in that casino plus the profit that they need for the casino and all the machines, the games, all of that have a slight edge on the house, on the house's side. And they're not 50% fair bets, right? Or there would be no casinos. There'd be just people outside flipping coins.
Well, maybe someday I will become debiased enough to walk away with some winnings next time.
Well, okay. Well, we're getting very close to the end of this discussion. I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much. I do want to mention that one other thing that I'm keeping my eye on is something called mental models. And I'll put a link on our Facebook page to the work of Shane Parrish, who's done a lot of work on this. And a mental model is just a representation of how something works. You know, it takes away all the details and simplifies things for us, like the map is not the territory. But those mental models can really help us understand things in the real world. They're kind of like ways of contributing to our system to thinking about things. Okay, any other real quick parting thoughts?
Not for me.
Okay, well, we'll want to give a big shout out and thanks to our listeners. And as always, thank you, Julia.
Thanks, Bob.
And until next time, keep thinking
clearly.
You got it.